political influence, and by the mid-1850s was regarded as a key player in the newly formed Republican Party. In 1858, he lost a Senate race to Stephen Douglas, but not before reminding spectators that a house divided against itself cannot stand. His eloquent articulation of Northern sentiment in a country poised for civil war earned him national recognition, and 2 years later, the Republicans nominated him to the presidency. He and his running mate Hannibal Hamlin were elected in 1860. Seven states had already seceded by the time of Lincoln's inaugural, and a month later, Confederate forces fired on Fort Sumter in South Carolina. The war consumed Lincoln's administration, and his moods blackened under the strain. Harshly criticized by both the people and the press, he often walked alone late at night to collect his thoughts, sometimes stopping to talk with strangers. Things were also dark on the home front. In 1862, the Lincoln's 11-year-old son Willie became ill and died. His parents were devastated, and Mrs. Lincoln's already fragile mental state deteriorated. Of their four sons, Lincoln called them his dear codgers, only one, Robert, lived to see adulthood. Americans reelected Lincoln to a second term in 1864. A month into it, Confederate General Robert E. Lee surrendered at Appomattox Courthouse in Virginia. 5 days later, on Good Friday, Lincoln accompanied his wife to Ford's Theater to see a comedy called Our American Cousin. Partway through the third act, he was shot in the head by an actor and Southern sympathizer named John Wilkes Booth. Lincoln died the next morning at the age of 56. Mrs. Lincoln would later recall a carriage ride she and her husband had taken earlier that day, when Lincoln had seemed happier than she had seen him in years.
With malice toward none, with charity for all, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and a lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations. Abraham Lincoln.
Welcome to the 16th in our series of programs on the American presidents. Today we are live from Springfield, Illinois, a town of 120,000 people in the center of the state, as we examine the life and times of Abraham Lincoln. Springfield was his home from 1837 to 1861 when he departed for the White House. On your screen is the old State House, where in 1858, then Senate candidate Abraham Lincoln made what is known as the House Divided speech. And now you can see the law offices, the Lincoln Herndon law offices, right across the street, where he practiced law with his partner William Herndon. And then about three quarters of a mile away from there is the home he and his wife Mary Todd Lincoln purchased in 1844, on the corner of 8th and Jackson, where three of their four sons were born and where one died. Joining us now on the program today from Springfield is Edna Green Medford. Inside that house, as you can see on the screen there, she's a history professor at Howard University. And David Long, who is the author of The Jewel of Liberty, Abraham Lincoln's Reelection and the End of Slavery, and also a professor at East Carolina in Greenville, North Carolina. Later, Linda Norbert Suits, curator of the Lincoln Home, National Historic Site, and historian Tim Townsend, also with the Lincoln Home National Historic Site. Then later in the program, some hour or so from now, Cullum Davis, who is the director of the Lincoln Legal Papers. We'll have our phone lines open. You can begin dialing at any point to join us in this program, which will last 3 hours here from Springfield, Illinois, on this June morning. It's 202-624-1111 if you live in the Eastern and Central time zones, 202-624-1115 in the Mountain and Pacific time zones. David Long, we go from James Buchanan, someone who most people have never heard of, to Abraham Lincoln, who everybody knows. What is there to say about how he ever became president in 1860-61?
Brian, from the moment that Buchanan took the oath of office, in March of 1857, things began to go very badly for the Democrats. The next day, the Dred Scott decision was announced, the most controversial decision in the history of the Supreme Court. That summer, the Lecompton Constitution, the bogus constitution prepared by the pro-slavery Constitutional Convention in Kansas, arrived and set off a rift that divided Buchanan from Douglas, the two most powerful Democrats in the country, the Democratic president and the Democratic leader in the Senate. Things continued to go downhill, one event after another. There was a financial panic that set off in 1857. The Lincoln-Douglas debates helped to bring Lincoln to national attention and prominence. Buchanan's was probably the most corrupt administration up to that time in the history of the presidency. And then the last thing that happened, of course, was John Brown and Harper's Ferry, which perhaps made the war inevitable. So a whole series of events had made it very unlikely that the Democrats would retain the White House and created a good prospect for the Republicans to take control of it.
And the great Med Ford, was Abraham Lincoln the first Republican president in history?
Yes, he was.
What was he like in 1860? Who knew of him?
Certainly by 1860, he was not as well known as some of the other candidates. In fact, there were several other candidates, and that's one of the reasons why he did win, because the Democratic Party was so divided, and these other candidates certainly could not garner the enough votes to be elected. But he was not that well known out of the state of Illinois, but was very well known, of course, in the Republican Party. The Republican Party was very new on the scene, but had made major strides since the mid-50s. When it was founded.
How many people were there in the United States in 1860?
About 31 million, I believe, about 23 million in the North, and about 9 million or so, 8 or 9 million in the South. And of course, 3.5 million of those in the South were enslaved people.
And how many states, David Long?
33.
How was it divided, slave states, southern states, right, and northern states?
15 slave states, 18 free states, with Kansas poised to come in as another free state when the war breaks out.
We've got a lot to talk about, and we have a call waiting, so let's get to our calls, and we can just continue our discussion on American presidents. Washington, D.C., our first call. Go ahead, please. You're on with Edna Medford and David Long.
Yes, sir. I'd like to make a comment in regards to the election of 1860. It's the your guests are correct in the fact that the Democratic Party was so disorganized at that time. However, I read a book in regards to an effort by a number of Democrats to pick a compromise candidate, and the interesting part is that compromise candidate wasn't going to run unless the other three that ended up running under various Democratic party statutes would go ahead, and then he would run if the other three would drop out. Stephen Douglas would not drop out. That compromise candidate happened to be Jefferson Davis, who had a lot of friends up north, actually, during that time, who was very well liked. And I just thought it would be interesting, like, to hear comments of your guests on that. Thank you.
Thanks. Professor Medford?
Certainly there were the other candidates were Stephen A. Douglas, who was representing the Northern Democratic interest, John Breckinridge, who was representing the Southern Democratic interest, and then there was John Bell from Tennessee representing the Constitutional Union Party. There was tremendous sectionalism in the country at that time, and that's one of the reasons why they could not the Democratic Party could not settle on any one candidate, because people were, at that point, voting along sectional lines.
In the election of 1860, what was the percentage of vote that Abraham Lincoln got?
40% of the total popular votes cast. Nearly all of those, of course, in the North.
And how about the rest of the candidates, the other three?
Douglas got about 29%, Breckinridge about 18%, Bell about 13%.
Next call, Houston, Texas. Go ahead, please. You're on our American President series.
Howdy, Brian.
Hi.
First of all, you just got those numbers exactly right. But I wanted to stack up two questions for the C-SPAN Library. First, my favorite citation of implementation of democracy. I wanted to know, and I wanted to know how much of this is fact and how much is mythology. Lincoln held a cabinet meeting prior to his signing of the Emancipation Proclamation, and he polled like three or four of his cabinet advisors whether he should or should not sign it. In this mini enumeration, it was three against one, and Old Abe said, one win. My second question is a little bit more complicated. What's his name? Wilkes Booth. I heard that Booth back in the early 50s or late 40s was involved in Kansas or maybe Nebraska with a future general in the Confederacy. Basically, someone shot somebody's son or brother or stepbrother, and then the other side returned the favor, and it turned into a Hatfield versus the McCoys type thing. I wanted to know if this is true and who the general was.
Thank you very much. On the Emancipation Proclamation, Edna Medford?
Certainly the cabinet was quite concerned. It was an explosive issue. They really felt that it was going to be extremely problematic for the Union. Lincoln was determined that this was the time to issue the proclamation and certainly did go ahead and do so. He did ask for advice in terms of changing some of the wording and so forth and did consider what they had to say, but he was determined at this point that this was the right time to issue the proclamation, and so he did so.
What about the Booth question?
Haven't a clue. Have never heard that John Wilkes Booth was out in the West and that was involved in something that involved the death of somebody. I can't speak to it.
I understand. We have another call from Houston. Go ahead, Houston. You're on the air.
Good morning. I want to tell you how much I and I think others appreciate your president series. I'm kind of a history buff, but I've been concerned not just about Abraham Lincoln's papers, but others. The Nixon estate is fighting over the ownership of the presidential papers, I believe, and tapes. All of this was produced by a governmental employee, the President of the United States. And all the papers, it would appear, that were produced during that time would belong to the government. I've not quite understand how the estate can suggest that they own the papers, or even the president own the papers, that they want to have presidential libraries, which I think is a fine thing, and let the public come and see those papers and hear the tapes. But why, or on what legal grounds, could they say an employee who produced the papers at the expense of the government or the tapes at the expense of the government retains ownership to such a thing?
All right, Connor, thanks. It's a little bit off the subject of what our show is about today, but let me ask a question related to Abraham Lincoln. How much money did he have? Do you have any idea when he was shot? How much wealth he had? You know, David Long?
I couldn't tell you how much accumulated wealth he had. He had done well. He had had a lot of expenses, of course, some of which were created by Mary Todd Lincoln while in the White House. But they were comfortable. They weren't going to have to be concerned.
And either one of you happen to know who owned his papers back then? I mean, there's lots of, you know, archival material. We'll talk with folks from this area and the National Park Service before the program's over. Maybe we can find out. Mm-hmm. Do you have either one of you have an opinion on the question about the Nixon papers?
Well, it's my understanding that initially his son Robert took possession of his papers, if I'm not mistaken. I really don't have a comment about the Nixon
Minneapolis, Minnesota, you're next. Go ahead, please.
Hi, how are you doing? It's a pleasure to talk to C-SPAN. Just one thing, three points quick. First of all, Abraham Lincoln abused civil rights, and he spent on the writ of habeas corpus, and he also sent slaves back to slavery, who the Union generals had freed, because he was concerned about doing it legally. But it is a fact that Abraham Lincoln did send slaves back to slavery after Union soldiers had freed them. And also, it's my opinion that when he issued the Emancipation Proclamation, is to give the Union cause a moral taint, so to give them a moral side, so prevent England and France from entering the war on the side of the Confederacy, which it very easily could have been done. It's a privilege to talk to you, C-SPAN. I've been wanting to call in for many years, and my grandfather and I always enjoyed setting presidents, and this is for my grandfather, passed on because he loved Abraham Lincoln. And Grandpa, this is for you. And Grant always said that Lincoln was his a favorite president. He said that Mr. Lincoln was always his favorite president. He's a big Lincoln buff. And another thing, too, but Lincoln did view civil rights, like G. Gordon Liddy said, that that the moral reason why the Watergate people did what they did was because of what Abraham Lincoln did during the Civil War. You know, he suspended habeas corpus. He threw people in jail. He shut down opposition newspapers.
Okay, Minneapolis, I think we got the point. You're starting to repeat what you said earlier. And I meant for what
yes.
did you say about this?
He did indeed suspend the writ of habeas corpus in those areas.
What does that mean?
It's the ability to arrest people and hold them in jail without actually having a trial. And it could go on for a long period of time. And in fact, some people are actually in jail through the duration of the war. He feels it's necessary to do so because there are a significant number of people in the northern areas who don't agree with him that this war should even be prosecuted. And so he finds himself surrounded, especially, you know, with Maryland, and there are people there who are very loyal to the Confederacy. Maryland certainly is not allowed to leave the Union, but there are people who are Confederate sympathizers, and they're causing some serious problems.
David Long.
Yeah. Brian, the prohibition on the suspension of the writ in the Constitution, just like the Second Amendment, people look at one part of it without looking at the other part. The other part of the prohibition says except in times of invasion or rebellion. So there are two circumstances in which the writ of habeas corpus may be suspended. If we are invaded by a foreign power or if there is an internal rebellion, certainly this Civil War is an example of a rebellion. So the constitutional authority to do so is there. The controversy about Lincoln's suspension of the writ has to do with whether or not he, as the president, should suspend the writ, or whether Congress should suspend the writ, because it comes under Article 1 of the Constitution, which defines congressional responsibility.
If you've just joined us, we are at the Lincoln Home at 8th and Jackson in Springfield, and on the screen you can see from high atop what we call a cherry picker, a little camera that shows you downtown Springfield, and you can see the state capitol there off to the left, and one of the office buildings right in the center. Right down to the right is the C-SPAN bus, and right next to that on the right there is the actual home, which is a two-story at this point. We'll find out how often or how long it was two-story. It's been changed many times, maintained by the National Park Service. And we'll meet some of the folks that are involved here in the history of this place. They get some 300,000 visitors a year. And we'll be taking calls over the next 2 hours and 45 minutes. Mark Parker is our producer of this series as we go to Princeton, West Virginia. Good morning.
Yes. What been overlooked often in the discussion of slavery was indentured servitude. I have personal knowledge of this. And a lot of the settlers in the West were descended from people that were actual indentured servants who had run away from that, their servitude or debtor's prison, which had created sort of a semi-peonage system. For instance, my great uncle was sold as an indentured servant by his father after the Civil War, even though this was supposedly illegal, and he ran away, and the sheriff, he was arrested more than once and brought back. He worked 14-hour days and was beat every night. And this system, the entire West was on the runaway indentured servants, the settlers, and I'd like to have the panelists comment on this situation.
And the Medport.
Certainly there was indentured servitude in the country, but by the 1850s, that's not the case. The people who are serving as unfree laborers are African Americans, and there are almost 4 million of those. If I may answer the question of the earlier caller as well, he talked about the return of enslaved people who had run away from their rebel owners. In the early part of the war, there was not a set policy about what to do with those people. Benjamin Butler at Fortress Monroe, Virginia, decided to label them contrabands of war, and he was able, and so he allowed them to come into the fort and he put them to work. There wasn't a set policy early on, but eventually they do address that issue. There are military commanders fairly early on who are returning runaways to the owners of people who were aiding the Confederacy.
David Long.
Yeah. Two specific instances that Edna's talking about. Out in Missouri, with John Charles Fremont and in southeastern South with David Hunter, military commanders had undertaken political action. They had freed slaves themselves. Lincoln's objection, of course, was not the freeing of the slaves, but the idea that military commanders would be doing it rather than the head of government. And that is the reason why, in those instances, he did not uphold what they had done.
We have some videotape of the birthplace area of Abraham Lincoln in Hodgenville, Kentucky, where you can see a log cabin that is inside of a mausoleum down there. And at this spot, the log cabin is actually not even the same size. I don't know where our videotape is. We're supposed to have it on the screen. And you can see the map there. Of there it is. That's a big mausoleum there at the Lincoln Birthplace Historic Site. And inside that is the log cabin, which is, they say, at the site was not the actual log cabin, nor is it, as I was saying, the actual size. It's a, I think it's a bit smaller to fit inside that mausoleum. And also, he moved from there for spent some time over at Knob Creek. Have you been there, David Long?
No, I have not.
Edna Medford, have you had a chance to see this?
No, I haven't.
We have a next call from Springfield, Illinois, right here where we are located. Go ahead, please.
Hello, Brian?
Yeah.
Oh, good morning, and welcome to Springfield.
Thank you. Do you mind talking right into the phone instead of the speaker?
Sure. Is this better?
Yes, much better.
Okay, great. My question, as you said, I am here in Springfield, and I happen to be an attorney here in Springfield, and most attorneys in Springfield have some memorabilia of Abraham Lincoln. However, as African-American attorney, I was able to find information, and more specifically a painting of Abraham Lincoln by a renowned African-American artist, Mr. Charles White of the Harlem Renaissance period. And in that painting, it shows some of the Afrocentric features of Abraham Lincoln. The broad nose, lips, it's very unique in style. And I bring this up to address the question I have. Could you tell us any authors or writers, historians, to give a perspective from slavery, the African-American perspective as to Lincoln as being the great emancipator or not? Of course, now recent children, school children, especially here in Springfield, believe that maybe Abraham Lincoln wasn't all that he was told or was viewed as in history as being the great emancipator and the freer of slaves, that this was done by economic expediency and to keep the country together. But has there been any black historians to talk on this issue, please?
Edna Medford.
Yes. Let me give you my favorite author on this subject. Benjamin Quarles wrote a book many years ago called Lincoln and the Negro. And it's very balanced, wonderful scholarship. He does address this question. I would send you back to that book. I don't think there's anything that has been done since then that's any better than that. It's a marvelous book.
What's your reaction to the inference that he has African-American blood or Negro blood in Abraham Lincoln?
That's certainly a story that has been circulating for a long time. Joel A. Rogers, decades ago, wrote a little pamphlet called Five Negro Presidents, I think, and Lincoln was included in that, so that's still circulating. I found nothing to suggest that he is of African-American descent.
Now, you are from Charles City, Virginia, the home of a couple of other presidents, William Henry Harrison and John Tyler. When you were growing up, did you learn anything about that part of the world?
Oh, yes. That's why I'm a historian.
Why are you a historian? How did it start?
Because I lived in an area that was so historically significant, and I was fascinated by the history of that county, and I couldn't imagine doing anything but what I'm doing.
Edna Medford has been at Howard University for 12 years now, and she did some work right out here in this part of the country, got her master's degree from the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana, where she spent a couple of years. David Long, how did you get interested in Abraham Lincoln?
As a child, my mother likes to tell the story of taking me through a department store book section, and I picked up a book and wouldn't put it down. She ended up having to buy it. It was a big picture book about the Civil War. And from the very moment that I became interested in the Civil War, the most compelling figure of the generation to me was Abraham Lincoln. And so it was a natural thing to follow from the initial interest in the Civil War.
Hometown, Middletown, Ohio.
Yes.
Got a law degree.
Yes.
Back in 1972 from Ohio State University, and got his PhD from Florida State in 1993, and has taught for the last 4 years at Carolina East Carolina University. We go next to Cincinnati, Ohio. Go ahead, please.
Yes, my great-grandfather fought in the Union Army, was a prisoner of war, captured and shipped to Virginia at a place called Clifty Point, a Confederate prison camp. At the same time he was in prison, Judiah P. Benjamin, and I'm getting this information from The Rise of the American Civilization, Judiah, published in 1927, Judiah P. Benjamin, Secretary of State of the Confederacy, a Jewish lawyer, sent emissaries to England and Ireland, telling them that any immigrants that came to the United States would be put in the army and forced to fight, when in fact they were sent to the United States to help build the railroads. Could you comment, please?
David Long.
Well, certainly a lot of people came to the United States during the Civil War. In the North, the population actually increased in spite of the 360,000 deaths that were a result of the war. Most of them came, or at least a fair number of them came, as contract labor. In other words, somebody paid for their passage so that they could work in the war industries that had to produce the massive amounts of munitions to fight the war. Particularly in this group would be the Irish, a large number of Irish, during the war. The gentleman's question had to do, I believe, though, with the South. And he mentions Judah Benjamin. I'm not sure that the South or the Confederacy had a similar program. And, of course, for immigrants to come to the South, they would have had to contest the blockade unless they came in at the North and then managed to go overland to get South. I'm not aware that there was a very significant immigration into the southern United States during the Civil War, but certainly in the North there was.
Let's go back to 1860 when Abraham Lincoln was elected president. How do you think at that point he became known in this country? What led up to, and what impact did the Lincoln-Douglas debates in 1858 have on anybody's knowledge of him in the 33 states?
The debate had tremendous impact. But before he's elected, what has happened is the country has gone through a horrific decade. It's a decade of tremendous sectionalism and great tension, great conflict during the period, starting with the issue over the extension of slavery into the territory that had been acquired by Mexico. And so by the time of the Lincoln-Douglas debates, the whole issue of the extension of slavery was on everyone's mind. And Lincoln and Douglas debated that issue, debated the extension, and debated the morality of slavery as well. And so as a consequence, he became well known in the state of Illinois, but became a leader of the Republican Party as well. And so eventually what happens is, even though he loses that election, it's a senatorial contest. He loses that election, but ultimately he gains because he really does come across. He takes the moral high road in this and is eventually able to capture the Republican nomination because of that, I think.
In those days, was there a telegraph? Was there railroads? And how did they move around? And how extensive was the transportation system then?
You're talking about two of the advances during this period that had significantly changed the speed of movement by which people could travel and how quickly word of or news got from one place to another. The telegraph was in place by this time. Civil War is often referred to, in fact, as the first telegraph war, the first railroad war. Railroads played a major part as well. So you certainly had had those things influencing the movement of people, and they certainly had an impact on the outcome of the war.
One last question, we'll take another call. We're in the parlor, where the kids were not allowed, I understand, and we'll find out more from Linda Suits later, but behind it was the original bedroom of Abraham and Mary Lincoln. When he was elected in the convention, the Republican convention, I believe in Chicago, and they came down here to tell him that, if I remember right reading Benjamin Thomas's book, it was at that point he learned that Hannibal Hamlin was going to be his running mate. Did he have nothing to say about that?
Well, certainly what they're trying to do is balance the ticket, as parties do now, and certainly Lincoln was willing to go along with that. He certainly understood that there would have to be that balance.
Either one of you know much about Hannibal Hamlin?
Not very much, but I just wanted to to say that certainly up to the time the nominations took place in Chicago, nobody knew that Abraham Lincoln was going to be the nominee. So in terms of consulting him as to who he would like to have as his vice president, nobody had really given serious thought to that. It was believed by many people, if not most, that William Henry Seward would get the nomination. What happened that morning of the nominations and the voting on the nominees is really a pretty incredible sequence of events to take place in a short time, all of which benefit Lincoln and hurt Seward. So he's not been asked about Hannibal Hamlin. He had met Hannibal Hamlin, but I'm not sure he would have had any reason to suggest that he would or wouldn't like to have him as running mate.
Abraham Lincoln is buried here in Springfield, along with three of his four children and his wife, and also William Herndon in the same cemetery. And Hannibal Hamlin's buried near Bangor, Maine. Let's go next to Louisville, Kentucky. Go ahead, please. You're on the air.
Good morning, Brian. How are you?
Fine. Welcome.
Enjoy your program. Just a way of comment, the telegraph was announced on May 24th of 1844, just for informational purposes. I had a comment and a question. The comment that I have is about Lincoln taking office in March of 1861. I guess what I've thought about is the Fort Sumter attack on April 12th of 1861. If the South had simply gone limp and not fired on Fort Sumter, just declared independence, just seceded, and then gone ahead about their business and ignored the North, I've always thought that it would have been very hard for Lincoln to mobilize the country in a civil war, and maybe the South could have prevailed in that way. And I wonder what your guests thought about that issue.
And the metaphor?
It certainly would have been more difficult to galvanize the North, but Lincoln could not have let it go at that. He would have had to do something to act. He was so wedded to the idea of union, there is no way he would have allowed the South to leave.
But he had committed himself to, we will not fire the first shot. You cannot have a war without being yourselves the aggressors in his inaugural address. So if the South had simply left Fort Sumter in place and not done anything, it's difficult to. And there would have been a crisis that would have come eventually. You couldn't have what was taking place in the lower South without there eventually being a crisis that would force somebody to take action. But Lincoln was very committed to forcing the South to fire the first shot, and it had. And the caller is absolutely right. It had a tremendous galvanizing effect in the North.
Our two historians here on the set, which is located in the parlor of the Lincoln home at 8th and Jackson in Springfield, are Edna Green Medford and David Long, and they'll be with us throughout this program. We're going to meet Linda Norbert Suits, who is the curator here at the Lincoln Home National Historic Site, in just a moment. Next call, Alamogordo, New Mexico. Go ahead, please. You're on the air.
Greetings from the lands of enchantment.
Welcome.
My question has to do with Abraham Lincoln. Relationship with his father, his mother, his stepmother, and his oldest son, Robert. And also, did he exhibit any outstanding traits of intelligence when he was a young man? Thank you.
David Long.
In most of the relationships that you mentioned, or at least in several of the relationships you mentioned, of course, there was some tension, there was some estrangement. Lincoln was not very close to his father. He did not attend his father's funeral. He also mentioned mother and stepmother. I have every reason to believe that Lincoln adored both his mother and his stepmother. I gave them a great deal of credit for who he was. And
let me show some videotape of the 14-year home in Lincoln City, Indiana, which is not a great deal of distance from here. You can see that on the map there. You see Hodgenville, where he was born, Lincoln City, where he spent 14 years. He was actually 7 years in Kentucky, and then move on to the Springfield, New Salem area. His father is actually buried in Charleston, near Charleston. There you have Lincoln City, Indiana, one of the log cabins in that area. None of these were there at the time, I believe. And his mother, Nancy Lincoln, is buried there. Either one of you know what year in his life that she died?
He must have been about 9 years old, I believe, when she died.
Continuing to look at some of the video from Lincoln City, Indiana, which is in the southern part, not that far away from Evansville and Louisville, Kentucky. Abraham Lincoln killed on the date?
April 14th. Shot on April 14th, dies in the early morning hours It's 7 o'clock a.m. on the 15th.
Looking at video from Lincoln City, Indiana, the Lincoln Boyhood National Memorial, which is available and open to, that's the gravesite of his mother, right there in the on the grounds. We're now going to meet a woman who has been at her job here for the last 8 years, and she will give us some perspective on where we're sitting in this room. Greg Fabick on the camera that you can see on the screen at the moment. Linda Norbert Suits, tell us something about this home that we don't know.
The rooms that you're sitting in are the parlors, very formal rooms. The boys were not allowed in those rooms. The Lincolns were very indulgent parents, but they didn't allow the boys in those two rooms. In fact, there's a letter to Lincoln as president, someone describing what's going on in Springfield, and they say that your house looks very nice. The Tiltons, who are renting the house, have no children to mess it up. So these rooms were always kept nice for visitors. The table in the back room, Lincoln had clients that he brought into the house and would work with them there. So he also used it as an office sometimes. The room that I'm standing in, which is adjacent to the parlor, next door to it, is the dining room. It's a rather small dining room, but a dining room nonetheless, and that was very important for the Lincoln station in life, that they have a dining room, that they have a separate room to eat from the kitchen. The help could eat in the kitchen, but the Lincolns could have their meals here. It was, by 1860, the time period that we're displaying in the house, it would have been Mary, Abraham, and the two younger boys, Willie and Tad, who would have been having their meals in this dining room.
How would you describe the relationship between Mary Todd Lincoln and her husband?
I think it was a close relationship. They relied on each other a lot. They had a lot of similar background. They both lost their mothers when they were young. They both enjoyed reading, and they both enjoyed their children very much. So I think they had a close relationship. Mary could be difficult, but I think they enjoyed each other's company.
We hear and read stories about when he would return after being out on the circuit and all come back, there were some screaming matches between the two of them. Or is David, you were going to say that?
There were some stormy moments. I think Linda's right. I do think they genuinely cared about each other. But I think they were both difficult people to live with. And that led to, Mary was a very high-strung woman. And there were some difficult situations.
Linda Suits, how did you get involved in all this in the first place?
Well, I'm a native of the Springfield area, although didn't have a particularly burning desire to work with the Lincoln home. But I got a degree in museum studies, and I went to the Chicago area and then came back to Springfield and eventually ended up here at the Lincoln home.
When people come through this house and they're in the area where you're in, what do they start to ask when they ask the Rangers questions?
They want to know a lot about how the Lincolns lived. And what they did in their house. And if you'll follow me, we can go on into the sitting room. And it's a really more family part of the house where you can really see more about what the Lincolns would have done.
Now, we're sitting on the other side of that wall there on your left, which we call this room where we're sitting the parlor. And what's that room called there?
This is called the sitting room. And it's a bridge between the formal public side of the house and the private family side of the house. This is where the family would have spent their evenings. The boys would have played over here on a table. We have a stereoscope. It's like a modern, toy for children. They'd put cards in there and they look three-dimensional in there.
Can I ask you about the kids? Let's just pick the year. Pick 1860, the year that he was elected president. How many children were alive at that point?
There were three children. In 1860, Robert was away at school. He was no longer living in the house. And Willie and Tad were living here in the house.
What year did they lose Eddie?
Eddie was just short of his fourth birthday and when he died. And he probably died in the back room, in the back parlor. That was the Lincoln's bedroom. So farther back in the room that you're sitting in is probably where Eddie passed away.
Well, Eddie and Willie and Tad all died. What were their illnesses?
We believe Eddie died of pulmonary tuberculosis. It's a little hard to say. The death certificates were not very specific. His said consumption, but we think it was tuberculosis. Willie died in the White House. Once again, they said malarial fever. It may have been typhoid. Tad didn't die until much later, until 1871, and he had pleurisy and pneumonia, and that's what he died of.
What were their relationships with their father?
Very close. Lincoln loved his children. There's even a quote that says he loved what his children loved and hated what they hated. And he liked lots of children. There's a story of Lincoln watching a parade downtown with all the little boys hanging on his coattails, and he's got a little girl in his arms. Sometimes he'd gather up the neighborhood boys, almost like a Cub Scout leader, and put them all in his carriage and go down to the river so that they could all go fishing. He tried to spend as much time as he could with them when he was here and always wanted them to be happy.
Linda Norbert Suits is with us in the Lincoln House. And I said earlier that there are about 300,000 visitors here a year. How many of those are kids?
About 20 to 25% of our visitorship, which is actually closer to 400,000 people, is school tours and bus tours. So almost 100,000 people that come through here are either school children or folks on bus organized tours.
And how much do they know by the time they've gotten here, what they've learned in school?
Wow, it varies so widely. It depends on how they've been prepared. Some hardly have any background at all, and some are very interested and really keen to find out a lot about him.
Now, you're going to walk from there into the hallway, I believe, next?
Yes.
Showing us, was this the front door that we're about to see back in Mr. Lincoln's time?
Yes, it was. And if on the outside of the door is the door plate. There were no house numbers at that time period. And so people put plates on their houses, and the one on this says A. Lincoln.
Can you open it up while you're there?
Sure.
Just go over there and open the door and show us what you're talking about. Is this the way everybody lived in Springfield at the time?
Correct.
See the front door. And they had no house numbers.
Correct. That wasn't until much later that house numbers were instituted. And a visitor would knock on the door or ring the doorbell. And there's a wire here that goes along the wall. And there's this nice little curlicue with a bell on the end. And this is the Lincoln's doorbell. Now, we've disconnected it so that it doesn't get damaged. But you'd ring the Lincoln's doorbell. This little bell would tinkle. And someone would come to the door to open it. Much to Mary's chagrin, Lincoln would open the door. Horrors in his shirt sleeves without even his coat on. Bad manners. The hired girl or one of the boys should open the door. And usher visitors in. And if it was a visitor for Mary, sometimes he might tell them that Ma was upstairs putting on her trotting harness and would be down shortly. And these are some of the things that I think got Mary's hot temper going.
Now, did you tell me this morning that when you took the little ruler home last night to your two kids, Catherine 6 and what, Sarah 4?
Correct.
That the 4-year-old looked at that ruler with all the president's pictures on there and picked out Abraham Lincoln?
She sure did. They know a lot about Lincoln. They've been here and they know his picture and they can pick him out on the money and can pick him out in a lot of different places, and they're always pointing out Mr. Lincoln. And we call him Mr. Lincoln because he wasn't president when he was here in Springfield. So they talk about Mr. Lincoln.
Linda Norbert Suits got a master's degree at Eastern Illinois University in 1987, and she's a graduate of Knox College in Galesburg, which was, the fifth site of the Lincoln-Douglas debate?
I believe so.
Thank you very much for joining us this morning. We'll see you a little bit later.
You're welcome.
And we'll go back to the phones. Our next call for our two guests here on the set, New York City. Good morning, New York City. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. My call is in reference to countries that were Southern sympathizers, and how did we go about mending fences with those countries who had supported the South with arms and or money, if we did at all? Thank you.
Thank you. Let me ask how close Great Britain was to the South then, David Long?
Well, they were pretty close. There were probably more British people who supported or hoped that the South would succeed. Of course, no small part of that had to do with the wish to see happen in the United States what had been done to Britain back in 1776. But trade that was conducted, of course, was not conducted between the British government and the Confederate States. It was between individual or private contractors in Britain and France and the Southern states. There was a great deal of friction between the United States government and the British government over just what recognition Britain would extend to the Confederate States, what she would do, how she would act towards the blockade, all of these things, and the fact that commerce raiders were constructed in Britain that did a great deal of damage to the Northern Fleet, to the Northern Merchant Marine.
We're going to meet Cullum Davis a little bit later in our program. He is working on the legal papers of Abraham Lincoln, who was a lawyer from this community. And we want to remind you that we have an educator's hotline for those of you who want to become involved, teachers who we're talking to. We have a C-SPAN in the classroom, American President's website, chance for you to get involved at no cost to you, especially if you're getting ready for the fall school year. Some starting in August and September. We have a lot of material that we'll make available as the year goes on, because we're just at president number 16. We have 41 to go. I mean, not 41 to go, but 41 in its entirety. And the telephone number to call if you want to get in touch with our education department, Joanne Wheeler's group, is 202-626-4858. And the number is there on the screen, and also the website address, cspan.org/classroom. AmericanPresidents.org is the website that deals with this whole series. Again, that telephone number, if you are a teacher and want to join at no cost to you, and there will be no future cost to you for this particular service, is 202-626-4858. We have 8 cameras here in Springfield, Illinois. That's a camera high above the Lincoln House, with the C-SPAN school bus off to the right and the State House off to the left in downtown Springfield, a community of about 120,000 people. And the mayor here in this community was over here to see us this morning, Karen Hassara, who's been mayor since 1995 and a big Lincoln buff, obviously, if you live here. For those who have just joined us, Edna Medford, bring us up to date the little things about Abraham Lincoln that give us a better picture. He was elected president in what year?
In 1860.
And when he was elected, how big a vote did he get, and how many people did he run against?
He got 40% of the popular vote. He ran against 3 other candidates, but was fairly easily elected in terms of the Electoral College vote.
Everybody writes that he didn't get any votes from the South. Are they talking about any votes or electoral votes?
I cannot recall if he actually got... Well, most of his votes came from, almost totally from, the northern states.
So how many times was he elected president?
Twice.
The second time around, do you remember what the percentage of victory was, and who did he run against?
I believe he got 55% of the popular vote, and he ran against George McClellan, the Democratic candidate, who had been one of his generals.
Now, he was a Republican, David Long. How about the Congress, the House, and the Senate? Do we know who was in control?
Republicans were in control from the moment that the Southern representatives and senators pulled out back in 1860 and 61. Now, they did suffer some losses in the House in the 1862 midterm elections, but they still maintained about a 17-vote majority. Also, they were calling themselves by this point, by late in the war, they were no longer calling themselves Republicans, but Union Party, because there were a lot of Democrats who supported the war, who actually supported the administration more than they did the opposition Democrats.
I read somewhere where that Hannibal Hamlin, his first vice president, was originally a Democrat.
Yes, he was.
You remember why he changed?
The same reason that many Democrats changed in the 18th, the major event that changed many people from their former affiliations to join the Republican Party was the Kansas-Nebraska Act, and what came out of the Kansas-Nebraska Act. Many people became disillusioned with the existing parties at that time and joined this new political grouping in the hope that it might be able to do something to make a meaningful stand.
Could African-Americans or blacks vote in 1860?
In some areas of the North, they could. In New York, they could vote, but there was a property qualification and a residency requirement for African-Americans only, not for anyone else. But I believe in 5 states of the North, they could vote. They could not vote elsewhere.
Could women vote?
Women could not vote. But women were very active in politics anyway.
Let's go to St. Augustine, Florida next. Go ahead, please.
Good morning. I want to thank you for this wonderful series that you're doing. Although I'm calling from St. Augustine, I was born and raised in Davenport, Iowa, just not too far away from there, and had some wonderful memories as a school person visiting on several occasions, both the Springfield site and the New Salem site. And Davenport was a place that had Lincoln had something to do with, and I'm wondering if perhaps Mr. Long might have some information on this, because I don't really recall it from those years ago. That was where the first railroad bridge crossed the Mississippi River. And it was a real problem there because of the steamboat lines, and there was some sort of a an incident where a barge was set afire and ran down into the bridge abutments and burned the bridge. And Lincoln was involved in that legal dispute.
Of his cabinet officers when he was president?
Seward was Secretary of State. Chase was Secretary of the Treasury.
Is that Salmon Chase?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Salmon Chase and William Seward?
Yes, that's correct. And Gideon Welles was Secretary of the Navy.
David Long, anyone else that you can mention?
Montgomery Blair was the Postmaster General. Edward Bates was the Attorney General. Edward Stanton was the Secretary of War for most of the war, although initially Simon Cameron had been the Secretary of War. Seems like there might be one person we're missing. John Usher from Indiana was the Secretary of the Interior.
I'm not sure where the next call is coming from because I haven't got a new one on the screen yet. Why don't we just go ahead and take it and they can tell me where they're calling from. Where are you calling from?
Washington, D.C.
Good morning. What would you like to say this morning?
I want just to talk about the role that African-American troops played in saving the Union and what role Frederick Douglass played in helping Lincoln to decide that it was time to enlist African-American troops. And in fact, was it the northern governors who were actually pushing Lincoln to enlist African-American troops also? They were like, well, we're losing men, and it looks like we're going to lose this war unless black troops are infused in the war. And I just
want
to get our comments.
Edna Medford.
African Americans played a very prominent role in assisting the Union in the war. There were as many as 180,000 men who served in the Army, at least 20 or more thousand who were serving in the Navy as well. The Northern governors really did press Lincoln to admit African Americans to the military effort because there was a conscription. The Northern governors had to make sure that there were a certain number of people from those states who were serving, and certainly as the war dragged on, it was more difficult to do that. And so they believed that with African American men joining, that would take off some of the pressure. In terms of Frederick Douglass, he was a thorn in the side of Lincoln from the very beginning, was pressing for the inclusion of African Americans, because African Americans at the beginning of the war saw this as a war of liberation, not just a war for the preservation of the Union, but a war for the liberation of the nearly 4 million enslaved African Americans as well, and they wanted a part in that whole struggle.
There's a home, the Frederick Douglass home in Washington, D.C., which is over in Anacostia, but he's buried in Rochester, New York, with Susan B. Anthony somewhere near him. What's that all about?
He had spent quite a bit of time in Rochester before coming to the Washington area after the war, and had published a couple of newspapers from that area as well. And certainly during the war years, constantly pressured Lincoln to not only admit African Americans as troops in the Army, but also to emancipate those African Americans still enslaved in the South.
We go next to Groton, Massachusetts. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm calling about Vice President Hannibal Hamlin. I'm just wondering why he wasn't renominated in 1864.
Good question. Thanks. David Long.
In 1864, the Republicans, or the Union Party, had an opportunity to make a statement that this was not a war about political parties, but about patriots and traitors, if you will. So there were, as I said, a number of Democrats who joined with the Republican in coalition during the war. Andrew Johnson was the one Southern member of Congress who did not leave when his state seceded. He was a senator from Tennessee who remained and really had no truck with the South, no sympathy. He despised the planter class of the South. By choosing Johnson, you have a Democrat and a Southerner on the ticket, which appears to give the ticket now represents the nation rather than simply a section and a party. And that was really the reason. There's been a controversy over the years as to Lincoln's role in the choice of Johnson. I think that Don Fehrenbach, the Lincoln historian, has pretty well settled that it really was undertaken by the party members as opposed to Lincoln. He certainly didn't object to Johnson.
Brandenburg, Kentucky, next. Go ahead, please.
Yes, hello, Brian. Thank you very much for this wonderful program. It may be a little premature to bring up this subject. I suppose you're planning on it sooner or later. But my impressions of Lincoln and the fact that we were so fortunate to have such a man at the helm at the time of such a crisis, and I've come to the conclusion long ago that he was a very complete human being. He was able to deal with secular things, but he was also undergirded by a tremendous spiritual strength. He didn't articulate this all the time, but he did quite often in his speeches, in his letters, speak of the influence of the Spirit of the Bible and so forth. I don't suppose nowadays he would even be allowed to because of the so-called separation of church and state, but I think that it's vitally important to know how much this man depended on fundamental principles of life and the definitions of humanity, and in insisting on those. Look how he depended on the spiritual aspects of the Declaration of Independence and all these sort of things. If they care to comment now, I'll hold up and listen.
Thanks. Professor Edna Green Medford.
Certainly he had a spiritual background, but Lincoln was rather suspicious of organized religion and never joined a church, rarely attended. So certainly that background was there. Read the Bible quite a bit, could quote it, very well versed in the Bible, but did not believe that organized religion was for him.
Thousand Oak, California. Go ahead, please.
Yes, Brian. I'm glad my call came in now because my second great grandfather was Abraham Lincoln's preacher and teacher. He was the third preacher at Little Pigeon Creek Church in Spencer County, Indiana, and was also his teacher at Troy, Indiana. And he's buried on Hurricane Creek in Perry County, Indiana. It took us 21 years to find his grave.
How did you go about it?
I've been doing genealogy for the last 40 years. And I had no idea when I was growing up back there that any of this was in my family's background.
How did you find it?
Just through going to the courthouses and everything. I made trips from California back there and went through courthouses and just dug anywhere I could find.
Thanks. Thanks a lot for calling. It brings up a question about archiving and genealogy and all that. You're involved in the new Lincoln Library to be built here in Springfield. Can you tell us about that?
It's still in the works. We're still planning it. I'm on the Scholars Advisory Board. I think it's going to be magnificent. What we're attempting to do is to make it very accessible to all people, just as Lincoln was. It's incredible how many different types of people he appealed to. And certainly, we're all attempting to make that library reflect the kind of person Lincoln was, and to make people aware of his complexity. I think we do a disservice to him when we prevent him from showing through the way he really was and all of his complexity.
Interested to find out last night from Norm Hellers, who runs this whole complex here, that Peter Fitzgerald and Dick Durbin have senatorial offices right down the street here in this little four-block complex that they rent from the General Services Administration and this group here. This is, if it turns out the way it's planned, I understand it's going to be a rather expensive library. That I think the city of Springfield is going to spend something like $10 million. There's a state is going to spend a lot of money on it. What do you think the use will be?
I would defer to the board member.
I mean, from your standpoint, is there a need for a national library devoted to Abraham Lincoln?
Certainly. I mean, there are archival sources, the Library of Congress, Manuscript Room, National Archives. There are Lincoln papers in various places around the country and libraries. But to have a central location where all of the different things relating to the life of Lincoln would be on deposit, to be accessed by a researcher, would be invaluable. Springfield has been that essentially up to now, but this, I think, is where they're now talking about doing it in a much bigger and better way than it has been in the past.
Buffalo, New York, you're next. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I'm calling to ask Professor Medford before commented on the role of women in the election and their strong influence in politics. I'm wondering if she could comment in more detail about their women's influence on the election of Lincoln.
Some women at that time, of course, women are not allowed to vote at that time, but some of them are actually writing about these elections. Some are making speeches, even though it's still frowned upon. Women are supporting in a variety of other ways as well. One of the things that drew Mary Todd Lincoln and Abraham Lincoln to each other was Mary Todd's love of politics. So she could converse about political issues as well as could any man during the period, and did.
Let me ask you about the number of times he ran for election of anything, do you know?
I couldn't tell you exactly because I'm not sure how many times he ran for and was elected to the State House in Illinois. But it would strike me that it must have been probably about 10 times total between the presidency, two runs for the United States Senate, then when he ran for Congress and won the congressional seat, and probably about 5 times for the Illinois legislature.
When did he actually serve in the U.S. House of Representatives?
From 1947 until 1949. He was elected in 46, but at that point in history, you didn't take your seat until more than a year after the election had occurred. So he took a seat in December of 47, and that Congress would have convened or would have adjourned in March of 1849.
Let's go next to Chautauqua, New York. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I'm curious about some of your comments pertinent to Lincoln being a true dark horse candidate. Several times you've addressed how did he become known, and I know that he gave a speech at a college in New York City called the Cooper Union, where he titled the speech Might Makes Right, and I'm wondering, did that speech foster his reputation in the big city political leagues, and did the New York City people then see him as less of a hayseed and more of a thoughtful, true candidate? I'll hang up and listen.
You bet it did. All of the New York Republican pundits of that day were there. They wanted to see this Westerner that they had heard about, read about, debating Douglas. The impression that Lincoln made at that, one person who was present said, nobody since St. Paul has had this kind of an impact. When he was done, the audience came to its feet as one. It was apparently Lincoln at its best, and he knew the importance of it, and he worked very carefully on that speech, and it was a very good speech.
Let me ask Edna Medford or David Long, either one, to fill in the blanks here. I saw when I was up at Hildene, the Robert Todd Lincoln home in Vermont, up in Manchester, a little note about the Cooper Union speech and what happened afterwards. I've not seen this anywhere else. It said he was paid $200 to give the speech and then went on to tour New England and give speeches. And one of the reasons he needed the money for his son, who was at Phillips Academy, because he had tried, to, I don't know, 13 or 14 times to get into Harvard and failed, but he needed another year at Phillips Academy to go there. It also reminded me that maybe back in those days you were making money speech making around the country, just like some of our folks are today. Can any of you fill in the blanks on any of that?
He received some handsome honoraria after the Lincoln Douglas debates. He was known everywhere, and he had a full schedule of speaking. He traveled across Indiana and Ohio, and then into the New England states. And the Cooper Union was sort of the final touch. I mean, that was some of the most important Republicans in the country. He has achieved legitimacy when he speaks to them and convinces them that he is forced to be reckoned with in the Republican Party.
We are going to come back to the two of you a little later on. We're going to let you have a break and go to some other folks and thank Edna Medford and David Long for joining us for the first. I've lost track of time, hour or so of our program here on a 3-hour program in Springfield, Illinois. Before we introduce you to a couple more guests, let me remind you that our educator number to call, if you are a teacher, this is for teachers, 202-626-4858. Number's on the screen. can become a member of C-SPAN The Classroom, and we'll provide you materials in connection with our American President series, which is going on all year long, and will end somewhere around December the 20th when we'll do the 41st President of the United States, William Jefferson Clinton. But today we are in Springfield, Illinois, our 16th President, Abraham Lincoln. His home is there on the screen at the right. You're looking out over the city of Springfield, a village of 130,000 people. And you're going to meet Cullum Davis at the Herndon Lincoln Law Offices in a few minutes. He's the director of the Lincoln legal papers. But for the moment, Tim Townsend is standing outside. Where are you, Mr. Townsend?
Right outside the Lincoln home.
What's your job here?
I'm the historian here.
And what does that mean?
Well, it means a lot of things. It means answering people's questions, whether they write or email or phone. It means responding to staff questions. It also means research the houses and the neighbors in the neighborhood here.
How long have you done this?
I've been here about 9 years now.
What can you tell us about this neighborhood?
Well, historically, this was a very mixed neighborhood, both racially, class-wise. There were everything from a successful attorney, Abraham Lincoln, to a state auditor, to African-American drayman or a carriage driver, buggy driver. It was a much different neighborhood in some ways than it is today. The streets would have been dirt or mud, would have been livestock roaming the streets, pigs especially, to kind of help clean up the streets. And this was the edge of Springfield at the time Lincoln was here. This was kind of a new neighborhood, basically.
Now, how long did he live in this house?
He was there 17 years.
Has it changed much?
Changed quite a bit. The Lincolns moved into a small cottage, one and a half stories, basically. And after about 2 years living here, they added a new room to the back, basically slid the kitchen wing over and added a room. Prior to that, there were basically a front room area where you folks are, and then across the entry hall, and then a back kitchen wing. The largest and most dramatic addition was in 1855 and into 1856 when they added the full second story to the home, basically reflecting Lincoln's growing prosperity and success as a lawyer and politician. He was able to invest in the home.
I mentioned earlier that the two senators from the state of Illinois, Dick Durbin and Peter Fitzgerald, have offices on this property. How often do they come here, and how much use does it get?
Well, with Senator Durbin, he's here fairly regularly. This is his main home office. This was also his office when he was a U.S. representative. Senator Fitzgerald is here when his schedule allows. I think his main office is up in Chicago area, but he comes down fairly regularly as well.
How many houses are there in this complex that are roped off?
Well, there's 14 historic structures here in the park, and the main area, the historic zone, as we call it, along 8th Street, is where the bulk of the structures are.
Now, if you get in a car and drive from Chicago, it's 3.5 hours. You drive from St. Louis, 90 minutes or so. How many visitors a year do you get, and where did most of them come from?
Well, we get to the site approximately 400,000 a year. There aren't quite that many actually go into the Lincoln home itself. Boy, they come from all over. You're probably right in Chicago and St. Louis being a large majority, but literally from all over the world they're coming. And of course, a large percentage of those visitors come, as the Rangers will tell you, in April and May with school tours.
And how much does it cost to come here and visit the home?
Well, the price is right. Tickets are free. You get them at the visitor center with a time on them and go in the home.
How far are we from the law offices?
About a four-block walk. We're here on 8th Street, and the law offices are on 6th and a couple blocks to the north yet.
Thanks, Tim Townsend. We're going to meet Cullum Davis at the moment.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Davis.
Good morning, Brian.
Tell us about the law offices.
Well, the law offices occupy an important corner of downtown Springfield. And, sorry, good morning, Brian. The law offices occupy an important corner of downtown Springfield, just across, literally across the street from the state capitol. Now we call it the old state capitol. And just a block away from the then Sangamon County Courthouse, where Lincoln argued literally thousands of cases. And just one floor above the federal courtroom. which was an important venue for Lincoln in the bankruptcy and other federal cases that he argued during his period here. This particular room was the court, or the law office, rather, of Lincoln's second partner, Stephen Trigg Logan. And then also Lincoln stayed here when he took on a younger partner, junior partner, William Herndon, in 1843. So this particular office is emblematic of the kind of room and books and chairs and even a daybed that Lincoln used as a lawyer.
When he was elected president in 1860, what kind of law was he practicing?
He was a general practice trial attorney by and large, although he handled some so-called office or non-litigation work. His principal activity was in the courtrooms of Illinois and even occasionally outside of Illinois. A trial attorney, that was his strength, his great interest, and it was what marked him as a particularly capable attorney.
How long have you been working on the Lincoln Legal Papers?
The Lincoln Legal Papers have been in operation now for 13 or 14 years. I've been with them for some 12 years, and we are on the threshold of publishing our first product, a massive electronic edition in facsimile format of all of the more than 100,000 records that we have identified pertaining to his law practice.
What will people get, and how do they get it when it comes out?
Well, late this year, the University of Illinois Press will issue the DVD-ROM complete law practice of Abraham Lincoln. It will exist on just three compact discs. We've managed to squeeze 1.5 million facts of information and about 250,000 pages of handwritten documents onto three discs on DVD-ROM, which is a more compressed version of what is more familiar to people, namely CD-ROM. They will be able there to access information and images from an enormous number of cases, some 5,000 cases, and all kinds of other non-litigation transactions. They'll be able to find the names of people who participated in Lincoln's practice. They'll be able to search certain issues such as slander or disputes over slavery. They'll be able to look for members of their family who may have participated as jurors or witnesses in Lincoln cases. They'll be able to search for the judgments in those cases, find descriptions of them. And in a vast reference section, they'll be able to identify and learn about the lawyers who practiced with Lincoln, the boundaries of the various court venues of Illinois, and a host of other information.
Our guest, Colm Davis, is a graduate of Princeton back in 1957. He has a master's from the University of Illinois and a Ph.D. from the University of Illinois, and is author of The Public and Private Lincoln, originally from Peoria. Let's take a call from Pocatello, Idaho. Go ahead, please. You're on the air.
Yes, it's good to watch your program. I really appreciate it. I'm wondering about the platform of the 60s and 64 of the Republican Party. How did they differ? Any thing on foreign policy and platform? I think there was something about 64 that was anti-slavery, anti-polygamy platform.
You're more interested in 64 than 60, is that correct?
Oh, either one. Both.
Either one.
I'm wondering how it evolved there.
Colm Davis, are you familiar with the platforms of the two parties back then?
Of course I'm familiar with them. I would think that David Long would be more qualified to speak in particular to the 1864 platform differences.
He's not here, but let me just ask you in general, back in those days, what were the differences in the two parties?
Well, obviously the extension of slavery into the Western territories, in particular in 1860, was the crucial issue. And the one that most basically separated the two principal parties.
What kind of a lawyer, I'm talking about not what kind of practice he had, but how would you rate Abraham Lincoln from what you know now as a lawyer?
Well, he was never anything remotely approaching the stature of Daniel Webster, say. He was never a great constitutional theorist. He did argue a few cases in the United States Supreme Court and prepare some documents for Supreme Court cases. But essentially, Lincoln was a hometown general practice attorney who took any and all clients on all kinds of issues, covering the entire gamut of legal actions in the antebellum Illinois. He was a man of great stature in Illinois, and by the time that he was elected president in 1860, he was known professionally, that is to say, as a lawyer, even on the eastern seaboard, so that he had earned a reputation as a very capable attorney, chiefly on the work that he did representing and suing railroads throughout Illinois. He became quite a successful railroad attorney during the latter years of his practice, and that earned him a reputation nationwide.
So when he left the U.S. House of Representatives in 1849, he had no public office until he was elected in 1860.
That's correct. In fact, contrary to a lot of popular imagery about Lincoln, he really gave up the life of politics when he returned to Springfield in 1849. He didn't expect to be in public office again. The congressional term had been a rather unsatisfactory one for him. And he said thereafter that I've been dabbling in politics, but his real bread and butter and the preoccupation of his life in the 1850s, at least up until 1856, was the practice of law, at which he earned really a very handsome income and traveled widely on the 8th Judicial Circuit twice a year for 2 or 3 months at a time. Argued cases before the U.S. District Court in Springfield and later on in Chicago, and of course handled a good many cases before the Illinois Supreme Court, which had its own chambers in the state capitol building just across the street from his office.
Our guest, Cullum Davis, we go next to Springfield right here in Illinois. Go ahead, please.
Hello, welcome to Springfield.
Thank you.
Very nice I guess I'll tell you, I took the day off of work just so I could stay home and work this phone. Get through. I'm not sure this is a real specific question for Mr. Davis, as he concentrates on Lincoln's work life. I've got more of an interest in the Lincoln's home life here in Springfield, because I've got ancestors on both my parents' sides of the family who had intimate relations and dealings with Abraham Lincoln, and one of them was a man named Stephen Green Eubank, who was Lincoln's neighbor at the Globe Tavern. Maybe Mr. Davis could tell us what he knows about the Globe Tavern and the fact that this society lady, Southern Belle Mary Todd, could have lived in a tavern, and the social relations between her and the class of people living in the tavern. There's a legend in our family about my great-great-grandmother being highly offended at being asked to babysit for the Lincoln children, and this was a class snub, basically. And there's other stories. I've got a great genealogy that came from one of my cousins, and I'm looking forward to seeing if I can verify some of the things that I found in it. A lot of it was compiled in the 1930s. So I'll let you go, and the question, I guess, is about the Globe Tavern.
Thanks for joining us, Mr. Davis.
Well, if the caller would contact us separately at the Lincoln Legal Papers, area 217-785-9130, we could tell him whether the ancestors of his actually interacted with Lincoln in the courts of Springfield. And it's quite possible they did. We have over 30,000 names of people who participated in Lincoln cases in one way or the other. But with respect to the Globe Tavern, it's important for the caller to understand that the word tavern had a different connotation in the 1840s than it has today. It was essentially a lodging place. It's true that meals and alcohol were served at the Globe Tavern, but it was a place to live. And so it wasn't a disreputable institution for the young bride, Mary Todd, to have inhabited that or to give birth to her first child at the Globe Tavern.
Mr. Davis, how many lawyers would sit in that one office there?
Well, there would be several attorneys sitting here. Lincoln was known to occasionally stretch out on the daybed and read the newspaper. Occasionally, particularly on Sundays, his children might visit here and cause some trouble, mess things up a little bit, driving William Herndon to distraction on occasion. But there might be one or two lawyers. More commonly, a client would visit Lincoln in this office and ask for his services on a particular case. And Lincoln would look up a few books, reference works he had. He had a set of Blackstone's commentaries and Chitty on Pleading and other sources that helped him look at the law in this case. Or you might travel over to the Supreme Court Law Library across the street and look up some of the citations from state rulings in other states or in Illinois that might pertain to a particular issue that he was handling.
We can only see you where you're sitting. How big a room is that, please?
This is a room that probably measures, I'm guessing, 30 feet by 25 feet. There was also a clerk's room adjoining this room. And later on in his career, Lincoln also had another room in this particular building, further south of here. But it was a commodious room, actually, as such facilities go. He had plenty of space, and he would chat here with his friends. It was a place where they might visit about politics or law or gossip around Springfield.
Cincinnati, Ohio, you're next. Go ahead, Cincinnati. You're on with Mr. Cullum Davis.
Hi, my question is, if Lincoln was elected not elected president, would the war still be fought?
Davis?
Well, that's one of those great if questions that historians try to avoid but can't resist making a half-hearted effort at answering. There very likely would have been a war had Lincoln not been elected, but that is conjectural on our part, and so that isn't what happened. And so historians try to deal and describe with what happened rather than what might have happened.
What, in your opinion, was Mr. Lincoln's talent when it came to writing itself?
We know he's admired as one of the most literate, if not eloquent, presidents in all of our history, and I think that's a fair judgment. There's no doubt that his work as a lawyer for some 25 years here in Springfield and around Illinois honed some of his talents for speaking and writing. Not that writing legal documents is a great preparation for writing the Gettysburg Address, because those legal documents can be rather stylized in their form. But the sheer practice of debating and arguing and the penmanship and drafting clear, lucid sentences was a wonderful experience for Lincoln to gain the ability to make a central point, a focus on that issue, clear away all the other verbal garbage, and develop an argument that was pointed and succinct, as indeed he did, of course, in the Gettysburg Address and some of the other great state papers for which he was responsible.
If you've just joined us, welcome to our 16th in a series of 41 programs on American presidents. We're in Springfield, Illinois, one of 33 towns in America named Springfield, and we'll be here for the next hour and a half or so. C-SPAN school bus is there on the screen. Downtown Springfield there in the background, and we're going to be with Cullum Davis here for a few more minutes talking about the Lincoln legal papers. Phoenix, Arizona, our next call. Go ahead, please.
Good morning, and thank you for having the most wonderful program on television. I'm in my 60s, and back when I was in grade school, I had heard that Robert Todd Douglas had given testimony about his father's assassination, in which he said that one of his cabinet members, and I believe it was the Secretary of War, was involved in that assassination plot. Can you comment on that, please?
I think our caller misstated when she said Robert Todd Douglas. She meant Robert Todd Lincoln, Mr. Davis.
Well, with the Lincoln assassination, as with every presidential assassination and other major events involving our presidents, there's a great deal of mythology and rumor, and those rumors simply will not die. The notion that Secretary of War Edwin Stanton in some way conspired with or participated in the conspiracy to overthrow the government or assassinate Abraham Lincoln has surfaced every once in a while, but historians have discredited that notion to their satisfaction, and there is really no truth to it.
When you published the Lincoln legal papers later on this year, by the way, what month will it be, do you know?
Well, it'll be the very early month or two of the year 2000. We will finish the work, and the University of Illinois Press will market and distribute it in January or February of the year 2000.
You know what it'll cost?
Well, it's going to be expensive. This is essentially a product designed for research libraries. It's comparable, say, to these microfilm editions of other great presidents. In our case, it would amount to some 120 reels of microfilm if we were publishing in that format. We can compress it all onto three discs. It will sell for in excess of $1,000 to libraries. They'll also, students of Lincoln and buffs of Abraham Lincoln or his law practice will be interested in acquiring this product as well.
Is there material that hasn't been published that will shed new light on anything?
There's no doubt there's a great deal of new material. We visited over 150 courthouses and libraries and collections around the United States over a period of about 8 years to find every available surviving source pertaining to his law practice. We found literally tens of thousands of documents that hadn't yet been inspected. We found actually hundreds of documents in Lincoln's own handwriting that were previously unknown to exist. And so there's a great deal of new material there. Many of those documents are fairly routine to a Lincoln buff, but will be of great interest to any legal historian who's trying to reconstruct the minutiae of a law practice from those documents.
But will there be, you know, so often when these kind of things come out there and are news stories that come from it, will there be news information that, you know, can you see a headline, Lincoln Papers Reveal Such and So?
It's hard for me to guess that. We have already had a great deal of press and media attention from the discoveries we made from time to time. A transcript of a famous murder trial here in Springfield in 1859, the longest document that Lincoln ever wrote that we discovered down in the Macoupin County Courthouse south of Springfield. So there's already been press accounts of major discoveries. Whether their publication in the form that we're making it will elicit a lot of other press gee whiz attention, I can't say. I suspect this will be regarded as a major publishing event in the annals of Lincolniana.
Well, David, stand by for a moment. We're going to talk to a student from Lincoln, Illinois, about his high school, which is obviously named after Abraham Lincoln. His name is Jeff Leesman. He's in the 12th grade. Good morning, Mr. Leesman.
Good morning.
How are you?
Okay.
Can you tell us how your school in Lincoln, Illinois, was named after Abraham Lincoln?
Sure. Well, originally the town here was Postville, Illinois, and Lincoln had surveyed land around the town and also heard cases in the courthouse there. And in the 1850s, the railroad was planning to be constructed between St. Louis and Chicago, and they had decided a station in this area would be the ideal because it's about halfway between St. Louis and Chicago. So the story is that three men had bought the land in order to lay out the town, and they hired Lincoln as their attorney because he was also attorney for the railroad and also a friend of theirs. And as they were in his office drafting legal papers for the town, he'd asked the men what they wanted to name their town, and they hadn't really thought about it. So they talked, and they decided they would call it Lincoln in honor of Abraham Lincoln, their lawyer. And supposedly, he was he really didn't know what to say. He said he didn't believe he'd do that. He didn't really know anything named Lincoln that ever amounted to much. So
how far are you from Springfield?
30 miles north.
And what year in school are you?
I just graduated.
What's next for you?
I'll be attending University of Illinois.
At Champaign-Urbana?
Right.
What are you going to study?
Engineering.
We have on the screen right now a piece of watermelon, some kind of a monument. Where is that in your town?
That's downtown, right next to the railroad. And that comes from, they were selling lots in town, and Lincoln was present, and he broke a watermelon and cut pieces for himself and the other three men that had laid out the town and poured juice on the ground and christened it with his name.
What do you think of Abraham Lincoln yourself?
I think that, well, he's, of course, a great president and a great man, and I think that everyone could probably look to him as an inspiration and
someone who did the right thing.
Jeff Leisman, thank you very much for telling us about Lincoln, Illinois. And before we let you go, tell us about Lincoln Community High School. How big is it?
It's about 1,100 students. And there's also an influence of Lincoln in that our nickname is the Rail Splitters, which comes from Lincoln, who worked as a rail splitter.
And what about the college in town? And many kids go from Lincoln Community High School to the college?
Yeah, quite a few do. And it's a two-year junior college named Lincoln College.
So you can't get much more Lincoln than Lincoln Community High School, Lincoln, Illinois, and Lincoln College.
Not really.
Thank you, Mr. Leisman. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
We're going to come back with phones now to Willits, California. Cullum Davis is still with us in the Lincoln Herndon Law Office, is not too far from here. Go ahead, Willits, California.
Yeah, my question is, how do you get information in regards to coming to visit these historical monuments? And can they be sent to me to see them?
Mr. Davis, I know you don't run the local Chamber of Commerce for the Lincoln sites, but if you, from your experience in living here, if someone's coming from outside, how much is there to see, and how would you go about learning about it?
Well, the caller should get in touch with, I believe it's called the Springfield Convention and Tourism Bureau, which has all kinds of printed literature about the various Lincoln sites and other interesting tourist attractions in Springfield. There's a lot to see here. There is not only the Lincoln Home, from which you have broadcast, and the Lincoln Law Office and Federal Courtroom, and the old state capitol, but there is the railroad station from which he departed with his family in February of 1861 to become president. There was, of course, the Lincoln Tomb in Springfield, where his remains are buried. And there is New Salem Village, some 15 miles northwest of Springfield, where young Abraham Lincoln struggled to find a job and a career and kind of a direction in his life before he moved to Springfield in 1837.
We're going to show some video of New Salem. How far from this location at 8th and Jackson is New Salem?
I think it's maybe 17 miles northwest. And it's a wonderful site for families to visit because it has reconstructed log cabins from the time that Lincoln was there in the 1830s, as you can see. Very interesting to walk around New Salem Village. It's easily a place where you could spend half a day just touring the various buildings that are available there.
Now, where did he learn how to be a lawyer?
Lincoln actually studied to become a lawyer in New Salem. He wasn't able to go to law school. In fact, as many viewers know, he never attended more than a total of maybe 1 year of formal schooling. But he educated himself prodigiously because he had an extraordinary ambition to learn and to succeed. And he studied law books. He borrowed law books from an attorney in Springfield, John Todd Stewart, who later became his first partner. And he read those books over and over again. He didn't even have the luxury of clerking for an attorney, which was a common means of legal education in those days, because there was no lawyer practicing in New Salem. At that time, Lincoln already was serving in the Illinois state legislature, but that only met once every 2 years. It did give him an opportunity to mingle with lawyers in Vandalia and later on in Springfield, but he essentially taught himself the practice of law and practiced by writing out simple legal documents before he actually was permitted to practice.
For the last 12 years, our guest, Cullum Davis, has been director of the Lincoln Legal Papers. He's in the Lincoln Herndon Law Firm offices down near the old state house. And we're going to go to Columbus, Ohio next. Good morning. You're on the air.
Thank you. Good morning. First of all, I hope your wonderful series will be available to us through tapes or something so that we can show our grandchildren 50 years from now this wonderful show. Last summer, my wife and I had the wonderful experience of traveling both to New Salem and Springfield, and it would be worth it to anybody to go see those. I noticed in the home, and I don't have any question but a comment, in the home looked very similar to one we might find today, with the biggest exception being in the kitchen. That would be the biggest change I've seen in homes of today versus then. Also, if one goes and visits the Herndon Law Offices, the Lincoln Home, or the old State House, All the tour guides there are very knowledgeable and pleasant. And I guess my final comment, if a person wants to feel what democracy means, go to New Salem and Springfield and see the place where our greatest president spent much of his time. And yet, the town of Springfield has a small, warm, humble, pleasant atmosphere, and you can see where our greatest president came from and how good it is still to see this kind of thing in America.
That's Thank you, caller. And on the screen right now, what you were seeing there was the Herndon Lincoln Law Firm offices. Let me ask Colin Davis the personal relationship between these two men. There's a lot of copy been written over the years about them. How did they get along?
Between Herndon and Lincoln?
Yes, sir.
I think they got along really remarkably well. There has been conjecture about how such different personalities could have interacted. But the fact of the matter is, Herndon admired Lincoln a great deal. Lincoln was the senior partner in this relationship. He was on the road a lot practicing law. Herndon tend to inhabit the office more. He was a more bookish figure than Lincoln, so he often looked up the citations and the precedents that would help Lincoln in deciding or arguing a case before the state Supreme Court. So Lincoln was kind of Mr. Outside, arguing cases in court. Herndon was more Mr. Inside, not exclusively, but largely that was the case. So they really got along well, and Herndon wrote a very admiring biography of Lincoln that scandalized some people because of some of the assertions he made about Mary Todd Lincoln and Ann Rutledge, Lincoln's early alleged love. But the fact of the matter is, Herndon's interviews with people who had known Lincoln and his own book about Lincoln are remarkable sources for us to understand the nature of the man.
Now, Ann Rutledge and Abraham Lincoln were together when near New Salem?
In New Salem. Ann Rutledge was a young woman in New Salem. They knew each other. It was a small village of just several hundred people. And there is some reason to believe that they had some sort of romantic relationship, though she had committed herself to another gentleman who then left New Salem. There's no doubt at all that upon her tragic death at a young age, Lincoln went into very deep mourning. And that is one of the bases or the sources for the long prevailing notion that she was his first great love. And according to Herndon, she was his greatest love.
Arlington, Texas, for Cullum Davis. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a philosophical question for Mr. Davis. Are people who live during the presidency, one's presidency, more accurate, or do we rely too much on historians who, by their very nature of their positions, belong to either the AP or the NEA, which are unions, and therefore have a liberal bias? Now, no man was more ridiculed in the press than Lincoln when he was alive. So perhaps the Lincoln legend has been exaggerated. Now, the best example of this I can give, because I was alive when Harry Truman, who was president, was so unpopular with his contemporaries that he could never run for a second term. Yet, if you read historians, the legend of Truman via historians does not agree with people's views who lived during the late 1940s. Now, is it the historians who are right, or the people, or both?
Well, I'll try to answer that question. Clearly, the caller has a point of view in asking it. Let me simply say that historians have the advantage of access to all of the sources, not just a particular point of view, and they also have the advantage of the passage of time, which gives them a perspective and a relative detachment. I don't think that it's fair to say that all historians are liberal in their bias or belong to certain labor organizations with a liberal bias. Historians try very hard, by the nature of their craft and profession, to take a look at issues objectively. That does not deny that contemporaries of presidents have a unique perspective, and we historians pay a great deal of attention to the contemporary views and the newspaper accounts and comments of people. But every great president has been defamed by the people living at the time, and yet they were elected. Harry Truman may have been unpopular at the time, but he was elected, and the same is true of Abraham Lincoln. I think historians have been very fair in their assessment of Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Franklin D. Roosevelt, Harry Truman, and they'll be fair in assessing the presidencies of the more recent presidents as well.
We're going to move on to the 17th president on July the 9th. If you're watching this live, it'll be a Friday. Andrew Johnson from Greenville, Greenville, Tennessee, which is over in the eastern part of the state near the Tri-City area of Johnson City. And also U.S. Grant will be July 12th on a Monday from the Grant Tomb in New York City up in the Upper West Side. And then our 19th President Rutherford B. Hayes will be at his home in Fremont, Ohio. Ari Hogenboom will be our guest, and that'll be on Monday, July the 19th. See that rundown there on your screen. Mr. Davis, can you show us on your computer there how this whole system will work? You said that it'll cost people about $1,000, but will they be able to go to a library and use it for nothing?
Absolutely. It'll be possible to access this information in any library that acquires the DVD-ROM. And it's really very simple to do because of a unique interface and software developed by my co-editor, Martha Benner. It's possible to search for cases or subjects. In this case, if someone were interested in railroads, they go to that subject heading, and by typing in RA, we immediately pop up to railroads, which I put in the subject, and then I can simply ask a question of the entire database to show me all the cases involving railroads. And the database is searched quickly, and we find out that there are 172 Lincoln cases involving railroads in one kind or another. One very interesting one that I'm familiar with is Barrett versus Alton and Sangamon Railroad, and we provide to the viewer a description of that case so that they can understand it quickly. We show that the various subjects that were covered in that, particularly contracts and breach of contract, and we show the two levels that were involved in hearing this case, both at the circuit court level and then the Illinois Supreme Court level. And we can get more details on that case, including the names of all of the participants, either by name alphabetically or by their role. And we see in this case, Herndon and Lincoln were the plaintiff attorneys. The defendant attorney was Stephen T. Logan, Lincoln's later partner. And over in this column, when it says yes, that means that you can find a biography of one of those other lawyers very quickly to assist you in that search. And then it's possible even to view some of the documents for that case. We have here a whole list of those documents. The letters are particularly interesting. For example, here I focused on one of the letters, which is a letter that Lincoln wrote.